High Haven on WNHH Radio, a program about everything Jewish in our community. Hey folks, this Sunday, September 24th at 2 p.m., New Haven's Jewish community is gathering to remember an episode in our history that we must never forget, and that New Haven has taken a leading role in remembering. The occasion is a Kever Avot ceremony at the Holocaust Memorial on Whaley Avenue by West Park Avenue, and it's for Yom HaShoah, the day of remembering the 6 million Jews murdered by the Nazis. New Haven's was the first such Holocaust memorial built on public land. Today in the WNHH studio, we are visiting with Faye Shepherd, one of three directors of the not-for-profit organization that runs our memorial. Welcome to the studio and Shana Tova.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
And I'm so glad that you made time to come in, Faye.
Absolutely.
You're a busy person. So this Sunday, September 24th, 2 p.m., people are going to gather at the park, and it is a park.
It's a park.
It's that corner. Unfortunately, it's a curved street, so the cars fly around.
I've almost
been hit there on foot. But it's a really great spot. It's a there's grass around it, and you have the Stark Memorial there, and benches for people to sit.
There's benches for people to sit, and it's sort of interesting. Community people come by, they sit, they reflect, or sometimes they just come by and have their lunch, and we've actually had some weddings held there. It's sort of
weddings
interesting.
Weddings at the Holocaust Memorial?
At the Holocaust Memorial. They see it as a beautiful park, and that's
okay.
But
no offense, would a Jewish person want to be married at a Holocaust?
It's usually not a Jewish person, but somebody who's not Jewish who sees it as a beautiful, peaceful place.
That's true, it is.
Which is also lovely.
And that's part of the idea, which we'll get
to. That's part of the idea, yeah.
Peace out of war. So there's going to be a, it's called the Kever Avot ceremony. That means grave of the fathers, correct?
Right, right.
Avot is fathers and Kever. Right. Why is it called grave of the fathers?
Well, at the end of the Second World War, as you know, we lost 6 million out of the 12 million Jews that were around in 1939 in the entire world, and we decimated, the Nazis did, the entire Jewish population that was left in Europe. There were about a couple hundred thousand people left out of the millions, and they totally destroyed the Polish Jews, of which there had been about 3 million and 1.5 million children. And so the war was over. We had some survivors left, and most of the people we lost were buried alive, burned alive.
I never knew that. Yeah. Oh, you mean the crematorium?
The crematoriums.
People often they talk about concentration camp and death camps.
Many of them were death camps.
And we heard so much more about the concentration camps because there was less information out about the death camps.
Right.
But Timothy, what's his last name, at Yale, has been writing these books about genocide,
right.
Snyder. He talked about the importance of concentrating, that the consequences were horrible, and a number of genocidal regimes have used those, or even not even genocidal. But what made this especially genocidal was camps that existed just to process en masse.
Auschwitz was that definitely so. Or they found reasons to burn people alive. And then the SS was very active. They would go into communities. They would line people up. My father, who's a survivor, used to talk about that. And they would just have these people, dig a grave, and then they would shoot everybody and then just bury them.
Uh-huh.
And there's actually a Catholic priest who's been going throughout Europe, and he's been finding more and more of these grave sites and uncovering what really had occurred in those years. But I digress a little bit to go back. Is we had no grave sites for most of our relatives and the people that were lost.
So that's why I say graves of the fathers.
That's why. So the survivors in the 70s built this memorial so they would have a place to go where they could say Kaddish. They could remember their family, remember their dead.
And on Sunday, do we say Kaddish at this?
We do say Kaddish, and that's primarily what this is about.
That's a powerful moment.
Yeah, it's a very powerful moment. We light some candles the way we always do for the dead that we've lost, for our family members. But we generally have a very short speech, and we try to have a third-generation person speak about this. But we really
a
want
third
to say
generation
Kaddish.
Mean the grandchild of a survivor.
Grandchild of a survivor to sort of carry on the tradition.
And if I'm going to ask you, could you move the microphone so you're directly head on it? I just like people to hear you better. No, like twist it.
Twist it like this?
The microphone part, the black part that holds it. You twist it to just face you. Okay, never mind. Because you're not head on to the mic, you're talking to the side of it.
Oh, like this?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
I'm sorry about that.
So
the community's going to gather at Whaley and West Park.
Right.
It's going to be a short ceremony. It's a beautiful space, but sad also.
It's very sad because everyone reflects and really thinks about who they lost.
And why is it important to do that, Faye?
I think we need to honor our dead. These people died only for the reason they were Jewish. It wasn't they were bad people or terrible people. And I think we also have to remember what a civilized society can do when we remember our own humanity, that we think about a society that decided to annihilate an entire people just for their religion. And I think that we continue to see that over and over. We have refugees, we have deaths, we have annihilations, we have torture, and this continues on. And we always say we will never forget what happened to our people, and we want to be active in today's world and to take a look at the atrocities that occur and say that we have to step forward, because in the 30s, no one stepped forward. No one stepped forward to help the Jews. Roosevelt knew about it, and that was what we saw on the TV program, the documentary they recently had. But no one stepped forward. There was a conference that was held in Europe about the Jewish problem, and everyone in the world walked away from it, and they left the refugees. Wow. They left these people to go into the concentration camps. Some of you may remember or know about the St. Louis that in 1939
right, turned back in the coast of Florida.
Got turned back. Everyone died in the concentration camps, the death
Rabbi
camps.
Rabbi Herb Brockman's bringing that up and speaking about Donald Trump's new policy toward refugees and other immigrants, and feels like it's repeating. And it's very tricky. It's important and also tricky to make historical parallels. But he definitely saw relevance in that,
sure,
why Jews should be speaking up on this.
Sure. I think we need to speak up when there's atrocities occurring, because it happened to us. And we know better than anyone what it's like to be alone in the world and to be abandoned, and that you need help.
And Faith Shepherd, why do we do it this time of year? So Sunday is 2 days after Passover. You know, Rosh Hashanah. So we have Rosh Hashanah Thursday night through Saturday night. I mean, through Friday night. Then we have Shabbos, Sabbath. So that's really the first day we could be out in the world again after our major holiday. Why are we doing it in the period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur? Because it's not really Yom HaShoah, the day of the Holocaust, right?
No, it's a different day.
That's in the spring.
We do it now because it's typically tradition to visit the grave sites of our relatives in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur.
Right. That's why we're doing it now.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's
interesting. We hold Yom HaShoah when we do, because of the Warsaw Uprising that occurred in the 40s in Warsaw and Warsaw.
And did that happen this time of year?
No, it happened around Passover. That's why Yom HaShoah is actually at that time, because it was the uprising.
So is there a second event at the memorial every year at Yom HaShoah? Or sometimes different parts of the community, right? I've seen it when it rains, it goes to JCC or Becky or something.
If it rains, we'll go to the JCC or Becky.
And that's also this Sunday?
That's also this Sunday, yeah.
Okay, and that's, and we're talking about New Haven's Holocaust Memorial with one of the people who keeps it going, both in spirit and in practice, named Faith Shepherd, one of three directors of a not-for-profit group. You're listening to High Haven and WNHH Radio, 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. So the history of this memorial, there's been, you actually helped produce a documentary about the history of this memorial.
We did.
1967, 70 families met in New Haven. They started raising money and making plans. Frank Logue, the mayor, then formed a committee, and there was a formal dedication on October 30th, 1977. And it was the first time in America, I think anywhere, a municipal government and a federation, Jewish federation, used municipal land to erect a memorial. Why do you think it happened, and what was the significance of that fact?
I think the survivors took a deep breath and looked around in the 60s, and some of the horror was beginning to fade, and they took a deep breath and said, where do we go from here? And it was terribly important for them to remember their family, because that hung over them. There's a little bit of guilt. Why did I survive when others did not?
And their kids feel that too.
And their kids
feel guilty about what their parents went through.
Yeah,
right?
I think for those of us who are children of survivors, you sort of live with that. They never had a childhood. They never had a happy time in their life. They always struggled. They work hard, and so they said it's time to do something, to remember, to take a look. And what's incredible is they went to the city, and they spoke to the mayor and some of his assistants, and they were able to obtain this property and this promise to keep it on a handshake.
Why do you think it occurred to people in New Haven and not in other places, or did it occur in other places they didn't have a mayor who was willing to work with them?
I think it began to occur slowly. We were just first. We were just early on, and we had great, great attention and support from the local politicians, from the mayor, and from the people. They were incredible in New Haven and saw the Jewish community as an integral part and an important part of the community.
Mm-hmm. So that happened, and you've now since, over the years, it kind of went in decline for a while, right? You were part of a group of people, Doris Alinsky especially, and Doris doesn't like to call attention to herself, but she's really quite a hard worker.
She's a hard worker.
Keeping this, no money, just getting this memorial going. At what point did you and she realize there was a need to, now, if we had the memorial built, we had events there, we're trying not to forget the Holocaust and have the community understand too, and then there was a decline, at what point did you say it's time to get this thing back in shape?
Well, about 10 years ago, Doris, who lives close to the memorial, took a walk by and she saw it was really falling apart. And what's really sad is we had ashes that were brought in from Auschwitz and there was a cover. The cover was coming loose. Some of the ashes were coming out.
And you buried ashes there from the Auschwitz concentration camp.
Right.
Is it below ground?
It is.
So
it
how
is.
Did she know on her walk that it was coming
something
up?
Something had blown apart, the cover on it.
Oh, wow.
Was buried with the cover, so it was, the trees were dying. The steel memorial that we have was beginning to crumble. It wasn't, they didn't have, the survivors didn't have that money at that time to have it last for 100 years. And so she called me up. She said, I think we need to do something. And then she called Eric Epstein, and we got together.
And Eric Epstein's an architect who also lives near, around the corner, Edgewood Avenue.
And brilliant, has done some brilliant work.
He's a great guy. He's a
great guy. Yeah. And we decided it was time to take a look. So it's really the three of us. No one gets paid for anything.
And you formed a non-for-profit.
We formed a non-for-profit, which her husband, Ed, put together for a dollar.
Greater New Haven Holocaust Memory, Inc.
Right, correct.
And so through that nonprofit, you raise money to keep the memorial up?
Yes, we have. We sort of
So what did you do? Did you plant new trees?
Planted new trees. Well, we replaced the stones. We had to replace.
And you have stones that represent each of the concentration camps, the death camps. What do they represent?
We have a plaque that represents each one of the concentration camps, the major 12 camps. The stones that are there, we have 6,000 stones to represent the 6 million that were lost.
12 camps, you know, major camps. That sounds like the 12 tribes, almost.
Yeah, yeah, I guess
like
you're right. That's a good parallel. Yeah. So we try to be symbolic. Trees and flowers represent life to us.
And it does look good.
It looks great.
Now, have you also, and I'm sorry, I don't remember the details of this. I thought recently there was some talk about you're engaging an existing society. Because there is to keep up the memorial, because it's similar to cemeteries. There have been some abandoned cemeteries that fraternal groups or non-existent, or no longer existent congregations have in New Haven and in the suburbs like East Haven, West Haven, Hamden, that have been in decline. And I know that I remember the Greer boys did a lot in trying to fix some of those up and keep records of everyone's grave. Were you looking for an organization to hire to keep it up?
We're looking for an organization or we're looking for a third generation to step forward, but somebody who's organized to take on this responsibility. Doris and Eric and I have done it for a lot of years. We've been very involved. And now we're really looking toward the next step, who will take this over.
I mean, someone mentioned the free burial and home loan and loan society, burial free loan Jewish society. Was that one of the ones you were talking to, or
perhaps
or the Jewish Federal Foundation?
Yeah, we've talked. Well, we've talked to a couple of cemetery societies.
And also, I've over the years we've written about this in the Independent. You have engaged volunteers in the community. You had kids from Hopkins School
do
some beautification, right? Do they do that every year as a community service project?
They come in every
year
and they help us.
What do they do?
They may mow the lawn, replace the flowers, clean up the leaves, get rid of the garbage that's left there. That does happen. We had one year, it's sort of interesting. I talked about the good people, but one year we found that the neighbors had dumped all their garbage there.
Oh, no.
In their diapers. And
oh,
actually,
no.
Yeah, my husband went down, and he was so disgusted, he just went and picked it up, put it, I think, back on their doorsteps. But the kids come down and really help. Also, the people from Chapel Haven come down, and we'll do whatever we need, whether it's the spring or the fall.
Oh, that's nice.
Marvin Cohen, who used to own a landscape company, still comes down and gives us advice and tells us which flowers to buy, which trees to replace. And Marvin has a heart of gold, does all that for nothing.
Faye Shepherd, do we have actual survivors speaking at this event? You said third generation people speaking. Are there any around yet still who can come talk?
There are not a lot. We used to have 300-400 people who came to this event who were survivors.
Wow.
Now we're down to maybe a dozen, two dozen people show up.
And are they able to speak? Or are they pretty infirm?
A lot of them have health issues. We do have Izzy Uden who will do Kaddish. He's 96 and going strong and doing extremely well. But I have to say to you, I think he's the exception. You know, we have Mrs. Zemkov who comes down, who is a leader in putting this all together, who collected $1 a week and put it into the Pushka to make the memorial. And Lulira's widow comes, Anna. He worked on this early on, Willie Rosenberg.
Was Lulira a survivor?
Lulira was a survivor.
The reason is the game was he run the sample shop downtown. I guess right. His son still runs it. But what's interesting about Lulira, first I knew about him was in the 90s, when he led the effort, a lot of energy, a lot of success.
Absolutely.
Resettling Soviet Jews.
Yes.
When that door opened and they fled persecution in a new generation and helped them get set up in New Haven very successfully.
Very successfully.
I love the way that the Holocaust inspires so much positive work in the Jewish community. I mean, we have to make sure we remember the horror so it doesn't occur again. And just as in saying Kaddish for an individual family member who dies, we have to deal with the grief and incorporate it into how we move forward in life and remember the people. But also, it seems to me what's equally important is how we live now and how we shape our world based on how that experience affected our community.
I think that's well said. I think that's actually what it is, to pass that torch on to the next generation, to remember, and tikkun olam, to repair the world, to do right, to have justice and equality.
Which we're trying to do here on High Haven, on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, and live streamed at newhavenandpenn.org. We have the pleasure this morning of chatting with Faith Shepherd, one of the movers behind keeping strong the Holocaust Memorial in New Haven at West Park Avenue and Willie Avenue, where this Sunday, September 24th at 2 p.m., there's going to be an annual Kevir vote ceremony. There will be actual survivors there.
There will be survivors.
And the whole community is going to be there to say the prayer for the Kaddish for the 6 million who died, including many from with roots here in our community. Kay, you're also saying Kaddish yourself, correct? In May, you lost your father.
I did.
Who was 90 years old.
Right.
Herman, and what a wonderful thing, because Herman was a survivor. You are the child of a survivor.
I am.
And Herman, and he was Herman Shepherd? No,
yes.
Herman.
He was Herman Shepherd, but his real name is Chaim Wolf Shapirka.
He survived. He made it out. He was born in Poland, and you've told me that as with many Poland names, the English letters are nothing like what it sounds.
Correct.
He was born in the Polish town of Sosnowiec, but as Sosnowiec.
Sosnowiec.
Even though there's no L in there.
Right, Sosnowiec.
And he was born there, and he was in several concentration camps.
He was.
And then the American soldiers liberated him from Buchenwald. He became a farmer in Plainfield, Connecticut,
but then
a real estate developer. He established the Plainfield Greyhound Park, very successful. Mm-hmm. Had a daughter, Faye, who became a successful investment advisor at Wells Fargo. That's you.
Yeah.
And that you also the board of the symphony in New Haven, the vice president. You clearly are very active in our community and someone who keeps it going.
We try. It's important. And
tell me, growing up as a child of survivor, you must have been very aware of the Holocaust. Did he talk about it much as he was rebuilding his life and working very hard?
It's interesting. My parents, who are both survivors, did not talk about it very much.
And is your mom still around?
She is.
Wow.
She is. She's 89 but has some dementia. But what's interesting is that my father, you heard him talking when other survivors came over, but they never spoke to us because they wanted to have a very positive experience for us. So my father talked about the American soldiers. My father talked about the MPs. My father talked a great deal about this Jewish judge by the name of Berman, who was in Germany, who helped the survivors, who went out of his way to look the other way to help all the boys and girls. Because my father was 17, 18 years old.
What do you mean, look the other way?
You know, they got in trouble. They handled, you know, as we would say, there was a little bit of blackmail. They were
after the liberation.
Yeah, after the liberation, they were trying to make a living. They had no skills. They had been to third grade. There was a big black market. There was smuggling of money. My father started a liquor shop
in Germany.
He started a liquor store, and he had a lot of the American soldiers that he sold to.
Oh, how old was he?
He was 18, 19.
What an enterprising guy. It's amazing survivors, how much life force they have.
They did. And you need to know he loved the Americans. He loved the American soldiers. He was very active in the VFW. He was an honorary member. He tried to start some housing for them, you know, about 8 years ago, but then he became ill.
He gave back.
He gave back. Whatever those veterans needed, my dad was there because it was terribly important to him.
So your dad, when you were growing up, you were aware that he was a college yes. soldier. Did you see the numbers on his arm?
He in Buchenwald, there were no numbers. There were some of the other camps. It depends where you were. But what my dad did talk about, I will share with you, is that he was in the death march for 6 weeks, January and February. And
was this 45, 44?
This was probably 44. And 10,000 people started and 200 people survived. And I will tell you what stays with me is that my office is on Long Wharf and I overlook the water. And he told me how in February in the snow and ice, the Nazis told them to go take a bath, to go into the river because they stank. And he went in and whatever, you know, and then had to get back out, had no towel, had the shirt on his back. And I think to myself, if you asked me to do that today, I couldn't do that. I wouldn't survive. Yet he survived.
What, because it was cold?
There was ice and snow.
Oh, ice
it was February.
Snow. Oh,
yeah.
My goodness.
Yeah.
So were they winnowing out the people, basically?
They were. They wanted them to die. They didn't want them to make it into
the Buchenwald. So he was probably 16 or 17 there,
right.
So they want to see who else could be left.
Right. They just wanted, I mean, this is how they got, how they depleted people. This is how they got rid of them. And they saved on bullets because they were running short on bullets.
So part of his reaction to having survived this experience was to give back the American soldiers and rebuild his life in a big way. From the minute he's out, enterprising at 18 years old, running a liquor business, coming to this country, being a farmer, then successful real estate business. You say he tried to keep it positive for you. What was the guilt he felt? Did you ever learn how he felt any guilt as a survivor?
What he used to say to me is that his mother told him at one point to run away. He was 13 years old, and in Sosnovich, his mother said, you know all the back alleys, you know all the sewers, you know all the rooftops, get out and save yourself. And she said to him, somebody has to survive. Somebody from this family has to live and to tell the story, and that's your job. And so he ran because she told him to. He went back at other times to try to save the family, but he survived in the streets and in the sewer systems for a long time.
But then how did he finally get caught?
He got caught. He was trying to help his mother and younger brothers and sisters. He was the oldest boy. He was 13, 14. And he had them hidden behind a wall in an apartment house. And he had a terrible toothache. And there was another family that was also hiding there. And he said, would you keep watch? I have terrible pain. And he fell asleep for a while. The Nazis came in, caught the other family, and the other family turned them in and said, if you take that family, you won't take my family.
Oh, my goodness. So the Jews turned against them.
That happened. We hate to talk about it, but that certainly happened.
And you think that other family was eventually caught too?
Probably. I mean, 99% of the people didn't make it.
And your father, 13 or 14, was responsible for keeping his family safe. What a quick way to grow up.
He kept them safe, and he broke the curfew. He went and got food. He went into the bakeries.
How interesting.
And he had, as we would say, Mosley had luck. He would go to a bakery at 4 or 5 in the morning as they started baking, and they put the bread out to cool, and he would steal the bread. And they saw him, and they never turned him in.
Why?
There was something about my dad. He had this energy and this life force that people trusted him. And I can tell you dozens of stories like that, that he should have been caught. Like, for instance, he was in a camp, and they had a backhoe or a big piece of equipment, and they said, who can run this equipment? Now, if you could run this equipment, it meant an extra piece of bread. So he said, I can run this equipment. Now, he knew from that like a hole in the head. So he got into the equipment. He began to run it. He jumped out before it fell over the side of the hill, smashed, fell apart, destroyed. And the Nazi running this situation, the scenario, when they asked, the supervisors asked what was going on, he said, well, you know, it's my fault. The brakes were no good.
Wow. So there was something about your dad. He was a survivor on his own. He took responsibility early. And the way he interacted with people, you meet people like that, summons some kind of grace or sympathy.
There was something, and I can tell you another story.
What a story.
Yeah, I can tell you another story that he was lined up early on, and I forgot which camp he was in, and they said, we need plumbers. Now, why it was important to be a plumber, you went into people's basements where people stored their beets and their potatoes and their carrots, which meant you could steal, I hate to say it, but you could eat something. You could survive a little bit better. So he's 13, 14 years old, and he says, I'm a plumber. And they looked at him, and he says, I'm a plumber. My father's a plumber. My grandfather's a plumber. Now, his father ran a tobacco shop. So they took him on the job, and he screwed up all
the... Was this in a ghetto, or was this in a camp?
This was in a camp, concentration camp. And they brought him on the job. He screwed up. They yelled at him. They said they're going to take him back, and they're going to shoot him. Because that's what happened. You lied, you were dead. So the foreman starts driving him to the camp, takes a detour, takes him to his warehouse, and says, listen, by 7 o'clock tomorrow morning, you're going to be a plumber. And spent the entire night. This is a wrench, and this is a hammer, and this is, you know, whatever parts there were. And spent the night so my father could survive as a plumber for the next few months.
Oh, my goodness. Now, who was this person who drove him?
This was just the foreman on the job who took a look at my dad once again and said, I'm going to help this kid.
What a story.
I mean, anybody else would have been shot, but my dad just had a way about him.
Wow. And you're hearing about Herman Shepherd on High Haven at WNHH Radio, your home for community radio 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenimprint.org. We're hearing from his daughter, Faye Shepherd, who's kept the memory of the Holocaust alive in our community, including keeping up the memorial at West Park Avenue and Whaley Avenue, which this Sunday, September 24th at 2 p.m., is the gathering place for an annual ceremony for those who perished in the Holocaust. Faye, did you feel guilt as a daughter of a survivor, or did you feel pride, mix? How did you feel about it? You said you tried to keep it positive, but at some point it must have hit you. My father survived this horrible, horrible experience.
I knew very early on. I think we all knew very early on, but what I felt was tremendous responsibility, and this is particularly true with the first child, that we had
And you were the first child.
I was the oldest. That we had to make everything perfect and right. We are not kids who got into trouble for the most part. We were good students. We were good kids because our parents had it so bad.
Like, how could you be mean to the teacher or steal something from a kid when your father survived the Holocaust?
Right. How could we be bad people? We had to make it good for them. We had to be perfect for them.
And
for them.
Tell me about your mom. What's her name?
Her name is Gertrude or Gitke. Unfortunately, she has Alzheimer's right now, but she had a different kind of a story. She was living in Yud outside of Vilna, which is, she says Poland, but sometimes it's actually Lithuania.
Don't you wish you could go back in time to when Vilna was Vilna?
Oh, yeah, the Vilna Gaon was there.
Go to shul and listen to the discussions about Jewish theology.
It was a major, major
intellectual center. Yeah, religious center.
Really was. But she went with her... To make a long story short, she got separated from her parents and was on a train with an aunt and uncle to go to Siberia, just staying ahead of the Nazis, and ended up in Siberia. But what was sad is her aunt was not good to her and would send her out to chop wood or to schlep in water when it was mealtime. And she survived because her cousin would steal potatoes and bread off the table and stick it into his pocket so she could eat later on.
So the aunt didn't want her to eat?
No, she felt she was a burden. It wasn't one of her children and resented her terribly.
Oh, my goodness.
So my mother always felt abandoned.
But she did stay away from the Nazis.
She did. And at 16, and I don't know if I could do this, she wrote to the military governor in Russia and she said, my parents are in Poland. I want to go see them. And she traveled 1,500 miles by herself on a train and came to her village.
Because then she could have gotten caught by the Nazis.
After the war. After the war, she was 16.
And her parents survived.
No. She went back to the house, and the local Poles were living in it. And when they And when they saw my mother, they said, what's the matter? Didn't you die? And refused to give her anything from the house. Nothing. Turned her away, slammed the door in her face.
16-year-old takes that long train ride in 1946, are we talking?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. So what'd she do next?
She went to her teacher's house who gave her a cup of coffee and then she tried to find where there's a DP camp. She tried to find
displaced persons.
She wandered around until she could gather herself together at 16, all alone in the world.
Did she go back to Siberia or?
No.
It's amazing we think about our parents' generation and how they operated versus the way our lives have been cozy. That's what I feel guilty about.
Yeah. I mean, our lives are a piece of cake. I mean,
so what happened next to Gertrude?
You know, she out of the garbage can. She ended up in a DP camp. She got married in the DP camp.
Your father?
Yeah, she had me.
They had you in the DP camp?
Yeah, I was born in a displaced person's camp.
You and Sam Gageson?
Yeah, actually, I came over in the same boat with Sam.
Oh.
I know Sam. Yeah, we came
over. But you wouldn't yet know each other because you were too young to talk.
We were a year old.
Oh, you were a year old.
Yeah. We were very young. But the families grew up near each other. We knew each other.
I thought Plainfield's in the east part of the state?
Yeah.
Okay, I was wrong about it. So his parents were also farmers.
He was a farmer, like the next town over. So we knew them.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you're Gertrude and Herman made it out, and they lived long, good lives.
They did.
And is your mom going to be there Sunday at the memorial?
No, it's too much for her.
Too much for her.
Yeah, it's too much for her.
And so one thing I wanted to ask you before we leave, Faye, is what is happening in the world now on two fronts. On one front is there's Holocaust denial. There always has been. There are people like the Ku Klux Klan, the Nazis, who want to act like it never existed. That's always been there. So we've been argued down. We've always had these real life survivors to show people. We go into schools and there have been anti-Semitic incidents. I remember Steve Spielberg went to one in California. You bring a survivor and have them meet them. What's going to happen now when there are so few left, when neo-Nazism is on the rise? You know, we've seen some of it in this country in Charlottesville, but in Europe, we're really seeing more of it.
Especially in London, we're seeing a lot in Great Britain.
And when we're seeing technology being used to alter reality so that you can make footage that looks real to say, someone say, I made up the story about the Holocaust that never really died, that you can go to an old movie now and change what they're saying and make it seem like it. What is the new challenge and how is what you're doing in New Haven figuring into the response to it?
I think it's our responsibility to keep the story alive, and it's why we're working so hard to get our video out and get it on PBS and get it on national stations so that we can show the world that this is actually true. I think I think all the films, all the videos, all the stories that are being taken and recorded are terribly important. It's why it's so important we say we're looking for a society, for a nonprofit group to help us so we can keep this going. The story has got to get out. We have to stand up and tell people and take the time and go to court and do whatever we have to do to keep this alive.
When you see what's happened to the Rohingya in Myanmar, when you see it, what happened in Rwanda a generation ago, we respond as Jews to those incidents. And yet it's not the exact same thing as the Holocaust. And that doesn't downplay what happened in their situation or ours. How do we apply what happened to us to these challenges in the world while keeping our own story distinctive and not being unaware of what's happening to other people?
I think that, one, you have to say over and over, this is our story. It's a different story. And it's different because it's a organized society that held conferences and bureaucrats who decided who would live and who would die and who was Jewish. A lot of what we see are sort of the renegades running wild. But I think you have to learn to stand up and talk to your congressmen and talk to your senators and look and talk to your local politicians and tell that story and just stand up for what is right.
Including congressmen who come over with you on a boat for displaced persons
Absolutely.
And babies.
Absolutely.
Hey, Shepherd, what a treat to get to know you today and to hear about the great work you're doing with the Holocaust Memorial New Haven. And thank you for being so open and sharing the story of your family.
Thank you. You're terrific, Paul.
And
I appreciate it.
And we're going to urge everyone this Sunday, September 21st at 2 p.m. to head on down to one of the great sites in New Haven, the Holocaust Memorial at West Park Avenue and Whaley Avenue, for the annual ceremony in memory of the people who perished in concentration camps and the life we're keeping going and the values that have survived. And to everyone, L'Shana Tova Metuka, a happy and sweet 5778. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Feel to Be Free from the Grief CD, A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all week long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.